was saying the other day, you turn them on self-destruct. Do they have a setting like that? Got to pay extra for that. Welcome to the new people. Who wasn't at either one of the classes yesterday? That's fine. We'll start all over. No way can I start all over. We've got this is a workshop, 4-day workshop, 4-session workshop on the first 5 chapters of a great spiritual classic in world literature called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life from the Mahayana Buddhist Indian tradition, and then the Tibetan tradition took that text up in a big way too. Translated into Tibet a long time ago and is central actually to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And we'll do the first 5 chapters, and we've gotten through 3 of them already. The real trick is the second session today. Chapter 4 is relatively straightforward and not enormously long, but chapter 5 is quite long. So we'll do our best to get through, pretty much every verse. May have to give short shrift to some of them. This is one of the reasons why it's a great text is that you can spend, your whole lifetime studying it. Kind of word by word, verse by verse. It's like the Bible, where people have spent centuries, kind of analyzing it, thinking about it, and interpreting it, and trying to understand it. And so, we do our best in 2 days, but it's a lifetime study. To study the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. The Bodhisattva is a person, is a being. Sattva means being, living being, who has awakened Bodhi, who has come to some kind of awakening. And the way they describe that awakening is in terms of what they call bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. They have a citta of awakening. So then, the question is, well, what does that mean? What's a citta? And there's a lot of different interpretations and translations of that word. The wish for awakening is one of the common ones that you'll find. I'm increasingly dissatisfied with that because a citta doesn't quite mean a wish. If you want to use that concept, it would mean the wish behind all other wishes. If you see what I mean, we have lots of wishes and wants and desires, but the citta really means something that's more all inclusive. Something that's more encompassing than just any one particular wish. So sometimes they divide bodhicitta into 2 parts. Remember, for the people who were here yesterday, the bodhicitta in the form of aspiration. I want bodhicitta, which is a wish. That's a particular wish. But real bodhicitta isn't that. Activated bodhicitta is different. It's a mindset, you could say. As opposed to a mind or a thought or something like that, it's a whole attitude. How's that as a translation? It's a whole attitude that informs every aspect of your life, you see? So yesterday I was talking about it as a kind of a new pivot around which everything in life then starts to orbit, as opposed to the present pivot, which is what? Take a wild guess. Me. The pivot of our lives, people who don't have, this transformative, bodhicitta is mostly me almost all the time, isn't it? Is it just me? Or is it all, is it just me who thinks it's all about me? All the time pretty much? So that's the kind of transformation we're talking about, a transformation that moves you from a state of a kind of a selfish, self-centered, self-oriented person to one who's thinking in bigger terms than that, who's thinking more cosmically than that, who's thinking in terms of the fact, and this is another understanding of what bodhicitta, what you are awakening to, you see. Bodhi means awakening. Well, what are you awakening to? And one of the things that you're awakening to is the fact that we are all connected. That no man or woman is an island. That the idea that everything revolves around me is an illusion. It's not just selfish, but it's illusory. It's ignorance to think that you're all by yourself out there somehow. that you don't have these kind of like massive interconnections with all other beings, literally. But, you know, at least with the, you know, people in your purview, right? People that you interact with all day long. And bodhicitta is an awakening to that realization, you see. The realization that we're not alone. None of us is alone. It's an illusion to think that we're alone. And, you know, and so it goes against the grain. I think especially against the grain of modern societies, especially modern Western societies, although, you know, Asian societies are, you know, kind of moving in this direction too, of the apotheosis. You know what that word means? The deification of the individual. We have all been taught our whole lives in this culture that it's good to be an individual, isn't it? That it's important to be an individual, that we need to be self-fulfilled as an individual, right? That we should be, you know, this is running in our veins. And you could argue that it's already there as a kind of a, you know, what we're born with. You know, we're born with this kind of self-orientation. But then it's been really exacerbated, really aggravated and exaggerated in modern culture. And increasingly, I think, the whole consumerist culture revolves around me. You know? It all revolves about what about me? What do I need? What should I buy? What experiences should I have? Am I happy? You know, the first-person pronoun. It's all about the first-person pronoun. So a text like this is, you know, which is not unique, of course, in world literature, world spiritual literature. There's no Me Sutra, okay? There's no the New Testament of Me. You see, no authentic spiritual tradition has ever taught that true happiness comes from ego enhancement. No, it's just the opposite, actually. In everyone, check me out if you don't believe. Anyone who wants to come with a sacred text that has any kind of legitimate authority over time to prove me wrong, please do. You know, I'm here throughout the afternoon, and you can run to Barnes and Noble and, you know, check. Go to the religion section at Barnes and Noble or spirituality, whatever you call it, and see is there any proof that this isn't the universal teaching of all authentic spiritual traditions. That our happiness will only come by letting the death hole that we have, and it's kind of like literally the death hole that we have on the ego, on the individual, on me, the snowflake self, you could call it. We all are individuals. That's kind of obvious, you see. You don't have to work at being an individual. You already are an individual. You're born an individual. You're born with your particular proclivities and genetic makeup, and, you know, you're born into a certain kind of family, into a certain kind of culture, into a certain kind of race, into a certain kind of, you know, language group. You know, we're all individuals, obviously. Big deal. You don't get extra points for being an individual. How about this? It's common to be an individual. Hmm? It's unique to not be one. So, you, I don't know, remember that some of you probably, this is a movie town, right? So you've all seen all the movies. Remember that one Life of Brian, Monty Python movie, where all these people are following around this guy who's, you know, as a messiah. It's just driving him crazy. They follow him everywhere. And so finally he, like, takes refuge in his own home, and they're all out in the, you know, outside in the plaza out there under his window. And he, you know, goes up to and opens the window and reaches, you know, comes out and he says, you know, stop following me around. Stop being like cattle, you know. You're all individuals, he says. And they, in unison, say, the mob, we're all individuals. And then there's this one voice in the back goes, I'm not. And he's really the only individual, you see? The one who knows that he's not an individual. That is not just special for being unique. We're all unique, you see? The hard thing is to let go of the grasping on how unique and special and, you know, awesome I am as an individual. And open yourself up to the connections that we have actually in truth, in reality, to other beings. You see? And this is the teaching, not just the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, especially in these chapters that we're going through, is an awesome teaching on this. But you find it everywhere. You'll find it in the New Testament. You'll find it in the Hebrew Scriptures. You'll find it in the Quran. You'll find it in Taoism. You'll find it everywhere. Got to let go of me. Got to let go of the self. And it's really hard to do that, you know? No, that's why we have what we call practice. It takes practice. So, you drop in, you have a little extra time on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. You drop in to, get 2 hours of haranguing. But if you don't, start practicing, start doing, start living, start putting into practice, it's just 2 hours, just another 2 hours gone, really. No effect much, you see, if at all. And so, we have exercises with each one of these classes to, to do something, to put it into practice. If it's not, it doesn't go into practice, really, it's just like watching a television show and there are probably better television shows than me to watch for 2 hours. Not many, but... You see? So it's hard work. It's hard work letting go of our selfishness and our self-orientation. It seems like almost impossible, doesn't it? It seems almost impossible. How can I stop that self-centeredness? And here's a little clue, okay? You can get some stoke up to do the hard work that's necessary to retrain your orientation. To have some approximation of bodhicitta, of a mindset that's thinking differently. That in a mindset in which all thoughts are thinking differently. You see? It's like the room, as I was saying yesterday. It's like the room. We're all in the room. Like all the people and all the things in the room are like little thoughts that occur within a space. Bodhicitta is like the space in which all other thoughts occur, all other feelings occur, for that matter. To get some approximation of that takes work. It's a caused thing, as I was saying yesterday. It's not there naturally for us, in a way. It's not there naturally. We have to cause it. We have to bring it into existence. We have to put the causes in place for the effect. And one way to get some stoke up to actually work at doing this, training yourself, retraining yourself to think differently and to act differently, is to remember how awesome it feels when you let the self go. These are the times of our greatest happiness, when we let go of the self. Now, what is the self? You see? Well, it's not some little mini-me inside of here. It's not like some little shrunken version of you. It's not a thing, in other words. What we call the self is not a thing. It's not an entity. It's an idea, and only, okay? It's not something. It's an idea about something. And that's the only way this... In other words, you could say, the only self we really have is a self-conception. You go looking around, the neuroscientists go looking around, poking around in the brain, where's the self? Where's HQ? Where's the command center? You see, you can't find it, it's not there. That's one aspect of what we think we are. We think we are sort of the master of me. I call it the Captain Kirk self. Captain Kirk on his spaceship Enterprise, just like shouting out orders to Scotty. And we think that there's some little Captain Kirk self in there that's just shouting out orders to not only our bodies and our minds, but to life. And it's absurd. Captain Kirk, doesn't get his way a whole lot of times. Have you noticed? Why would Captain Kirk ever give the command, have a bad day today? Scotty, raise depressors, Just be sad all day. Or why would Captain Kirk say, clog up the 405. I'm getting ready to go to work. Clog up the 405, you see? Obviously not a master self like that, a commanding self like that. There's no permanent self, unchanging self. That's another sort of self that we grasp to, isn't it? Sometimes they call it the witness self. Like there was a witness who just watches your life go by unchangingly, You know, there's somebody who watched you when you were 3 years old, you know, toddling around, and they watched you when you went to grade school, and they watched you in junior high when you went to the first prom, and, you know, and just like watches your life go by. Who is that watcher? Where is that watcher self? It's an illusion. If you could find the watcher self, okay? Ready for this? A little head bending here, little noodle baking. If you could find the watcher self, who would have found the watcher self? See, if you could identify in your mind, I have found the watcher self who is really me. Who's the I that found that? It's a conundrum, isn't it? And that should give us a clue, you see? The fact that when we go looking for the self that we think exists, a master controlling self, an unchanging self, and a unitary self, a self that's one instead of like taking on multiple roles all the time, shifting multiple roles all the time, can't find it. It's like looking for Waldo. It's the find Waldo from hell. You know what was those Waldo things where they've got like billions of people on the thing and there's this little dude with the, you know, the funny hat on and the glasses and you try and find him? You know, when we try to find ourselves, you know, we're trying to find Waldo and it's the worst case scenario because Waldo isn't there. No Waldo to find. Trying to find the needle in the haystack, but there's no needle. You see? So it's a kind of an illusion. It's just an illusion. And when we drop the illusion of the self exists only as an idea of the self. Or if you'd like to put it like this, the self exists only as self-consciousness. When we're self-conscious, you know, when the little voice is chatty. You got a little voice in there? Or again, if it's just me, somebody better like take me to the hospital or something, you know. But I think everyone's got some little voice in there chatting all the time, mostly whining, right? Mostly complaining, mostly saying, I wish you were different. How long is this going to go on? It's too hot, it's too cold. I don't like the snacks. I don't even have any snacks because I have to sit here and listen to this guy, you know, right? Constantly chatting in there, constantly chatting. That voice is the voice of self-consciousness. You see, that voice is who we are, actually. You know, to the extent that we're anything other than just an idea, it's that voice, you see? And so again, another little noodle baker. If we are that voice, you see, if that is the self, as it were, if that's our self, are we the talker of that voice or the listener of that voice? You see? Every time you go searching for what you think you are, who you think you are, it gets very muddled very quickly, which is mostly why we don't do it at all. Because we don't want to confuse ourselves, you know. We already are having crisis, self-identity crisis, and we don't want to have like a real one. But the self is always in an identity crisis because it's not there. Just an idea of the self. And you know, if you like think about that for just even a few minutes, that's very good news. That the only self that exists is an idea of the self. Why is that good news, do you think? Because you can change it. If there was a self the way we think there is, you know, kind of like unconsciously mostly, subconsciously, you know, a master controlling self, an independently existing self, an unchanging self. How could you change it? How could you improve yourself? So self-improvement is a matter of changing not the self, but the conception of the self, which is the only self that exists. And conceptions, can conceptions change? Yes or no? Can your ideas about things change? So can your interpretations of things change? Yes or no? So that should give us all great hope. So that's one of the good news. About the fact that we are empty, they say in Buddhism, empty of self, un-Atman, no self. And that's one part of it. The second part of it, and the way to like get some stoke up when it comes to actually working to really realize that, you see, is to remember what it feels like when you're not there. When the voice shuts up finally, you see? And these, I'll just tell you, quick cut to the chase. These are our happiest moments in life. Is when we can lose ourselves in something else, in something bigger than us. We need to transcend ourselves into something bigger. So something transpersonal, you see. So we have all kinds of experience of this. In a way, we have an experience of this every night that we have a good night's sleep. That's what we call a good night's sleep, is that I wasn't there for 8 hours. Ah. The voice completely shut up. When we have dreams, especially nightmares and stuff like that, it's restless sleep. It's not that sound, right? But when we have dreamless sleep, it's because we're not there, right? We have night, hopefully, unless you got insomnia or like big problems with dreams all the time. We have some kind of experience of what it feels like when the grasping to the idea of the self, the self-consciousness, ends temporarily, right? And we're relaxed for the first time in 24 hours. Totally relaxed. We have this experience in deeply pleasurable experiences. When we fully are involved and engaged in an activity or, you know, even watching a movie, a good movie or something like that, let alone in the throes of sexual climax, which is when you, that's why it's ecstasy, you see? They call it ecstasy. Ecstasis means you have stepped out of yourself. Stasis means standing. Ex means out. You're out. You're not there. If you're there in, you know, your so-called blissful sexual experience, it's not a blissful experience. If you're sitting there going, I think I'm having a blissful experience. You see, if you're narrating your experience, you haven't lost that self. You haven't lost the self-consciousness. It's when that voice shuts up and we stop the narration, the inner narration, and are fully engaged in reality, whatever that reality is at that time, is when we're happiest. And these kinds of moments, these kinds of experiences, are pointers, they're indicators as to what the goal really is. The goal is not to improve, ultimately. The penultimate goal is to improve the voice. So the voice, instead of whining all the time, starts saying nicer things, happier things, right? But the ultimate goal is to have the voice shut up altogether. That's what samadhi is. That's what nirvana is. That's what, you know, moksha is. That's what liberation is. That's what salvation is. Is unself-consciousness. And I would put it like this, like I said on Friday. Mindful unself-consciousness. And we are perfectly capable of that. We have experience of that too. We are mindful as we engage in our hobbies, for example, and lose that little voice because we're so preoccupied with what we enjoy doing. And we do it well, right? We try to do it well, but we're not sitting there going, how should I do this now? How am I? Blah, 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 blah. You just do. You just act. Skillfully, mindfully, but just in pure action, you see. So the guides of the Bodhisattva's way of life is, you know, is telling us to, you know, is instructing us on the benefits of being less selfish and more selfless in life. And the bodhicitta that I've been talking about is a mindset that isn't thinking about me and how I'm feeling and how I'm doing and what's going on with me. It's losing itself in the service of others. Which is another way you can lose yourself. It's one thing to lose yourself in a good movie, which is why we call it a good movie, is because you're not sitting there criticizing it all for 2 hours. That's what makes a good movie, all you Hollywood honchos here. Right? You get absorbed. The audience is absorbed. And, you know, like 2 hours go by like that, right? Because you weren't there. That's one thing, because that's a little bit mindless unself-consciousness. Your mind's not working. You're just absorbing what someone else, you know, kind of like has put in front of your face in 3D. There's a difference between that and mindful unself-consciousness. And there's a difference between all kinds of mindful unself-consciousness experiences, too. You know, when I used to surf here in Southern California, and oftentimes got into the flow, as they say, you know, kind of literally, when you're surfing, of mindful unself-consciousness, where, you know, you're actually, it takes a great deal of skill, actually, to surf or to do anything like that. But you're not sitting there, like, thinking about it, you know, self-consciously narrating it. And it's very, very pleasant to go surfing. It's pleasant to, you know, it's pleasant to do a lot of these kinds of things, these hobbies or, you know, these other kinds of experiences. Rock climbing, apparently, is quite like that. if you, you know, you really get into the zone in rock climbing, because it, partly also in these experiences, because there's kind of a lot at stake. You know, there's a danger involved, and that's part of the appeal, actually, of the experience, is because it requires, you know, it really, you know, brings out your skills. You have to really, you know, survive. You've got to survive. Motorcycle riding, for anybody who does that, is of the same order, especially in a place like Los Angeles, where, you know, you just got to, like, keep alive, you know. And you can't be just sitting there chatting about keeping alive and deciding which way to turn, what, you know, all of that. Accelerate, decelerate, you just do. So there's a difference, but so that those are wonderful experiences. Those are what they call peak experiences in life. And they are very important experiences for what they point to, you see. Why are they so pleasant? You see, why exactly? And I'll tell you the answer, because you're not there. Because you have a brief, you know, relatively brief and finite experience of what it would feel like to be selfless. And so in the religious traditions, you know, they tell you, they also embrace that state. They try to move you towards that state. But the methods that they use are designed to be more long-lasting, to be more permanent in their transformation, not just like a brief motorcycle ride or, you know, a two-hour surf session, but for a lifetime, to live a lifetime of unself-consciousness, mindful unself-consciousness. And one of the principal ways that not just Mahayana Buddhism, but many traditions, Christianity also, teaches that, is to devote yourself to others. Lose yourself in the service of others. What can I do for you? What can I, right? Because then you're not there also. You see, there's some, it's like, again, on, you're kind of like on automatic pilot. You're mindful, but it's kind of automatic. That's what bodhicitta is. Bodhicitta is on automatic pilot, helping others all the time. You see, mentally, physically, verbally, or whatever, because it's the space in which your mind and body act. You see, it's the arena in which life occurs. You know, your life occurs. So it's pretty awesome, wouldn't you say? Chapter one. How awesome is that? Okay, that's the review of chapter one. No, it's anushamsa. Anushamsa means praise. Just praise a state of mind like that, an attitude like that. You know, it would be awesome if it arose in anybody's mind. You see? And if it arose in mine, it would be awesome too. You see, it's like that. You know, no matter where a state of mind like that occurs, it's going to be damn awesome. Right? So the second one is, well, how do I get, the second chapter, this is a review yesterday. Second chapter is, how do I get a state of mind like that, Shantideva? You know, this is the author of the text. You know, yes, I think I'd like that. How do I get that? And he says, first of all, clean up your act. Clean up your act. You know, we've all been living as selfish pigs our whole lives, and we've hurt a lot of people. We've done a lot of bad things, you know, negative things. So we have to clean our conscience of that. We kind of like got to clean the Starbucks cup before a new latte is poured in. Because the present Starbucks cup is pretty grody. You know what I mean? So we clean our conscience. And the primary way to clean your conscience is through the purification, you know, exercise. And for those of you who weren't here, I'll just quickly go through it. First and foremost, you admit and regret it. And you know, this is hard enough for us. We, you know, we don't like to admit that we have made mistakes. And so, it's a little bit helpful, I think, in that enterprise to realize that you're not alone. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone has made mistakes. You're a human being. What'd you think? That you were separate from the rest of us and somehow, like, shouldn't have ever made mistakes? Human beings make mistakes. All human beings make mistakes. You're not special for having made mistakes. Okay? Everyone's made their own individual snowflake mistakes, but as a mistake-making species, we're all the same. Homo mistakeus. So that helps a little bit, right? To say, like, okay, well, you know, I'm like everyone else. I'm not special. I made mistakes. I admit my mistakes and then regret. Says, I wish I hadn't done that because look at me, you know. I'm tormented by my mistakes. I'm carrying around all this guilt and, you know, and disappointment and, you know, self-hatred and stuff like that. You've got to clean that. That's very important, okay? That step is as important as any of them, maybe even the most important. Regret it. You see, admit it and regret it. Then make some kind of, like, you know, commitment to try not to do it again. You see? Restrain yourself from doing the kinds of things that you know in the past have brought you nothing but problems and misery. Guilt. You see? Why keep reinventing that wheel over and over and over again? You see? Stop it. Just stop it. Right? And then some kind of restitution, some kind of activity that acts as a kind of a counterbalance to the other one, right? To the negative one that you're trying to clean. Which is the fourth one? I'm missing one. I forgot now.
Refuge.
You know, think about what kind of a person you really want to be. Do you want to be an unhappy person the rest of your life, tormented by guilt and, you know, carrying around all this crap on your conscience? Is that the kind of way you want to live this short and precious life? Okay? So that's second chapter. You clean the system up. And the third chapter was, remember, parigraha. Bodhicitta parigraha. Grasping on to onto this kind of transformative way of thinking and being in the world. Grasping on to bodhicitta is a very interesting verb. Parigraha. You know, because usually in the text they say, oh, parigraha, let go, stop grasping, don't be attached. But this is, as we'll see in today's class actually, Shantideva kind of turns the table on goody-two-shoes Buddhists all the time. He says, like, don't get attached to, like, detachment. Don't get attached to detachment. Attach yourself. To what? To bodhicitta. To that transformative state of mind, you see. We're all going to be attached to something, you see. All going to, and again, like I said yesterday, attachment, you know, parigraha can also be understood as devotion. Attachment is a kind of devotion, isn't it? And so we're all devoted to something. We're devoted to money, we're devoted to our careers, we're devoted to our friends and family. You know, we're all devoted to sports. You know, some people are very devoted to sports. They know everything about sports, you know. No, how many, you know, home runs this guy hit and all of that. Devotion. That's devotion. Attachment. So why not bring that same kind of energy that, which requires a great deal of energy and work to be devoted to something, to devote yourself to a transformed mind that instead of, you know, circling around me all the time, opens up to a larger whole. Opens up. So that's how far we've gotten so far. Chapter 4 today. Everyone got their reading? Anyone need reading? Just a break in the action here. I'm going to take my jacket off. Okay? So chapter 4 is called Bodhicitta Pramado. Pramada. Pramada is an interesting word. It comes from a verb, mud, which means to go crazy. Mud comes into English as mad, M-A-D, same word actually. Mad, not in the sense of angry mad, but in the sense of crazy mad. So, apramada, so that's the word here, apramada. So pramada means, you know, you're kind of like wacky. You're disjointed. You're not focused. So apramada means the opposite of that. Vigilant. Taking care. Being heedful. Right? Something like that. So not negligent. Not negligent. So I've translated it here as staying vigilant about the bodhicitta. About the wish. So you've already, I mean, you're kind of presuming here. That this chapter unfolds sequentially. So there's a kind of presumption that there's some kind of version of bodhicitta that you've gotten in the third chapter. That you got in session 2 yesterday afternoon. So now that I've got it, it's a cause thing, right? I brought the causes and conditions into play. And by the way, Here's one of the main causes that they say in the text, in the Buddhist text, that brings about bodhicitta. The realization that we're all equal. Absolutely equal. Underneath all the superficial differences, the real thing is that we're all pretty much the same. We're all very much the same. So what they call equalizing yourself and others, and then what's the second sort of shoe that drops in that method that rings about the cause? Equalizing and exchanging. Your happiness is as important as mine. Because why? Because we're equal. I don't have any kind of like special claim over happiness or the relief of suffering. We're all the same. And so you can practice that. See, that's the discipline. That's one understanding of the discipline that would bring about bodhicitta. That would bring about a transformation of mind. And you can see how that would work, right? Because the pivot changes. The pivot switches. Not just me, 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 me. Because I am most important here. My happiness is way more important to me than to you, than yours, right? We're all like that, isn't it? And somehow my deserving of happiness and the end of suffering is somehow more important than your deserving of it. You see, we think that that's an unbodhicitta mind. See, that's the absence of a bodhicitta mind. So when we get the bodhicitta mind, we get it because we realize that we're all the same and that we all have the same claim. The same basic claim. Dalai Lama does this all the time, by the way. You listen to Dalai Lama, read the Dalai Lama teachings all the time. This is the great democracy. This is not just the people, but of all living beings. All living beings have a right not to suffer. And all living beings have a right, equal right, to be perfectly happy. And you're not different. You're not more important than anyone else when it comes to that. And that's the way to get the cause in place for this transformative bodhicitta. So now, chapter 3 assumes that you've gotten some version of it. And I think, you know, if you've come to some teachings and you worked at it a little bit, we all have some version of it, okay? We have an approximate version of it. And that's good. So we work with what we got, right? We don't wait around and go, oh, I'm not a bodhisattva yet. You know, I'm not saintly enough yet, so I won't even try. See? Not like that. We do, you know, what is it? Pema Chodron says, begin where you are or start where you are or whatever that is. Yeah, so you start where you are. And everyone's got something, some version of some kind of compassion, some kind of understanding of altruism and, you know, and the feeling that we get, the gratifying feeling that we get when we finally do something selflessly, even a little bit, you know? Like when you actually get over all of the, you know, me, me, me-isms and, you know, try to help somebody who needs help or try to give somebody the perfect present, not the one that's convenient for you to buy, but the one that they really want, you know? You know how you feel like that, right? When you feel after that, that's also another little hint. It's another little intimation about what bodhicitta really means and how happy it would be, happiness-making it would be for you to have it. So we all have some version of it, hopefully. If you don't, you're probably like, you know, a psychopath or something, sociopath. So we all have some version of compassion and love and altruism and stuff like that. So how do we guard what we have? So this is now, there's two chapters on this, on how to be careful in life so that we don't damage our little seed, our little sprout of whatever kind of, you know, sprout we have of some form of bodhicitta, so that it doesn't get damaged, because it could. It could get damaged and we could lose it. Because it's a cause thing, we could lose the causes for it, you see? We could lose the causes that perpetuate it, so we have to guard it. The second chapter that we'll do in the second session is actually called that, guarding, mindfulness, guarding attention so that you don't like lose it, so you don't like just, you know, kind of, because you haven't been paying attention, you just revert back to an old selfish kind of a mindset. This one is called, you know, this one's called being heedful, being vigilant in your life. Those of you who like to keep score of such things, in the commentaries, they say that chapters 4 and 5 refer to the second of the six perfections. The six perfections are how to live like a bodhisattva. These chapters are how to think like a bodhisattva, but the first three anyway. But now these four and five are sometimes categorized as the second of the six perfections, which is what? Ethics. Ethics. How to live a good life. How to live carefully. You see, if we don't live carefully, we are not living a good life. I mean, as simple as that. If you're on automatic pilot, the pilot that's on automatic is not a good person, probably. No, it's a flawed person, it's a selfish person, it's an egotistical person. That is our default position, unfortunately. That is our default position. So if we're going to, you know, if we're going to have a shot at living a good life in the ethical sense, we have to be careful. We have to live carefully, mindfully, and train ourselves to have different kinds of instincts. You see, our inborn instincts, you cannot trust them. Okay? Or you can put it like this. You can trust them to be 180 degrees wrong. Your inborn instinct. When someone like slaps you upside the head, well, you know, what's your instinct? You know, when someone bombs your buildings, what's your instinct? You see? It's at the personal level, it's at the group level. It's our instinct to just do exactly the thing that brought us the experience that we're reacting to in the first place. Violence comes from violence. That's where violence comes from. Getting, stealing, you know, theft of your stuff comes from your own stealing, from your own disrespect of other people's property. This is the law of karma. This is a universal law. It's in all the major traditions. You shall reap what you sow. Which Swami said that? Swami Huzi Watsinanda. From the exotic east in India. Who said that? You shall reap what you sow. That's Jesus. So Jesus taught karma, of course. Because karma, what they call karma in the Eastern traditions, is the principle of morality. If you do good, good will come. If you do bad, bad will come. And if you don't have a belief in that, you don't actually have a system of morality. You see, if you think that sometimes I do good and then bad comes, or sometimes I do good and good comes, and sometimes I do bad and good comes, and sometimes I do bad and sometimes bad comes, and you think it's all kind of random, that's kind of what it means to say you don't have a system. There's no system there. It's just, you know, who knows? Whatever, right? Whatever. And many people live their whole lives like that. You know, they just don't have no real faith. So whatever they can get away with, you see, then morality becomes whatever you can get away with. See, if nobody catches me, then it's okay to do whatever. To steal, to bomb, to kill, to whatever, as long as I don't get caught. As long as nobody hurts me as a result of it, immediately, you see, that's all right. All right, so staying vigilant. Let's get going. A child of the Buddha, that's a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is somebody who has had the transformed mind that they're talking about with bodhicitta. A child of the Buddha, since they've tightly embraced the wish, again, the verb is grihipha, you know, parigraha, they've like, you know, attached to it, the same verb here. They've grabbed onto it. They've attached themselves to the wish to awaken, must always make tireless efforts not to neglect the train. See, not to just say, ah, you know, I've achieved it. Ah, you know, I'm a good person. You know, I'm an altruistic person. I'm a selfless person. Now I can relax. Can't relax, you see, because it's not permanent. It's not a permanent transformation. For those of you who care, you know, who are studying in the deeper levels of Buddhism, it's not like nirvana or enlightenment. Neither nirvana nor enlightenment is caused. Okay? Because it's always a possibility. It's always there. It has been there since beginningless time. This is the nature of Buddha, what they call Buddha nature. We don't cause Buddha nature to arise. We realize what's always been there all along. And the same with nirvana. The same with nirvana. Nirvana is the state, is kind of our, you could call it our natural state. But then it's been occluded, occluded? Messed up. Screwed up, messed up, smothered by all of this crap that we overlay on it. But bodhicitta is not like that. Bodhicitta is a cause state, something that you can work towards. And once you have achieved any version of it, full version of it or some approximation of it, you've got to protect it. That's what he's saying here. So to not to neglect the training, not to transgress, ati karma, not to overstep, you see, not to get too big for your britches. Yeah. There are lots of texts like this. There are several texts like this that I know about. The Uttara Tantra also says, at the end of, I think, one of its chapters, first chapters, it says, you know, somebody who gets bodhicitta might start thinking that they're better than everyone else. You see? And then you've got the cause of losing bodhicitta, actually. If you take pride in your bodhicitta as being some kind of like awesome personal experience, personal achievement, then you've actually planted the seeds to lose it, you see. All right, here we go. It is important to consider whether or not to do what has been rashly undertaken or not properly considered, even though one has made a commitment. Which commitment is he talking about here? We talked about it in the third chapter, actually, the second class yesterday. We came across some verses that really are used, nowadays as part of a vow ceremony. You take a vow, and this is actually an ancient tradition that a bodhisattva vows, takes some kind of vow. I will stay with suffering beings until all other suffering beings go into complete happiness and enlightenment. I'll just stay around. I'll defer my own personal happiness until everyone else achieves it first. You know, that's a kind of a vow, a very typical vow that you'll find in the text. And so he says, okay, so maybe you took a vow like that, or some version of a vow. Instead of like some cosmic version, maybe you sat down here at the Mahasupa Center and put your hands in a clasp in front of your breast and started reciting some blah, blah, blahs. After your preceptor told you, you know, now you're going to take a vow, say this after me, blah, 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 and you said blah, blah, blah. And the blah, blah, blah that you said was actually a pretty awesome promise. It was like, I'm going to be a saint. I'm going to be a selfless saint with the rest of my life. And so he's saying, like, maybe you shouldn't have done that. No, this verse, it actually says that. Like, it's important to consider whether or not what I've rashly undertaken. You know, maybe I didn't think this through well enough before I like made a commitment like that to transform my whole life. Or not properly considered. You know, I should have thought that thing through a couple more weeks maybe. Or years or lifetimes. But now you made the commitment. You know, he's talking about people who have made that commitment. And then he says, next verse, but how can I neglect what has been well examined by the Buddhas, their offspring, and even by myself to the best of my ability? He says, somebody didn't like rashly undertake this kind of thing. Somebody actually did properly consider like what would be a good way to live. The awakened ones, the spiritual ones, the, you know, the saints and so forth, they figured it out. So even though I might not have like kind of fully, you know, thought it through, somebody else did. So if I now kind of renege, you know, I'm gonna let them down in a way. I'm not only going to break my promise, but I'm going to let down the people, the beings in whom before whom I swore to try to live a life like this. I also wanted to say in relation to verse 2, in general, okay, in life, in general, not just, you know, reading about bodhisattvas, it's really good not to make promises that you don't keep. It's really good not to make promises that you don't keep. Or I'll put it positively. It's good to make promises that you do keep. And all of us are guilty of not keeping our promises. You know, we say things to other people. I think in L.A. the phrase is, let's do lunch. Which means, I think, decoded, I hope I never see you again. Right? To just like blah, blah, blah with your mouth. To write checks with your mouth that your body can't cash. Right? To not follow through on what you say you're going to do. And actually, in some of the texts on karma, they say this is a karmic cause. Not doing what you say you're going to do for depression, for low self-esteem, which makes sense actually if you think about it, because you don't value your own words. You see, it's a form of of low self-esteem already to not value your words enough to actually follow through on it. You see? And then it comes back at you as you think you're the kind of person that can't follow through on their intentions, on their words. And that's kind of a definition of low self-esteem, right? So in general, it's good to keep your promises. And the way to keep your promises, a little practical advice, is not make promises that you can't keep. So keep your mouth shut more, maybe, about what it is that you're, declaring you're going to do, or, who you're going to see, or, when you're going to show up for lunch and all like that, see? Better to not say anything than to, basically a form of lying, isn't it? It's a form of lying. Say, I'm going to do something and then not do it. But how can I neglect what has been well examined by the Buddhas? If, having made this commitment, verse 4, I don't succeed in putting it into action. It's easy to blah, blah, blah. But now, you see, this is a transition into, not just thinking, not just a change of the mind, but now the actions that that mind change would inspire. See? So if it's just a just a mental thing, what much good is that? You see, if having made this commitment, I don't succeed in putting it into action, I've lied to all of them. I lied to my vow master. I lied to all the invisible powers that I called up. I've lied to myself. What then would be my fate? You see, what happens to people who just who lie to themselves and others over and over and over again? And it's not pleasant. See, anybody who has experienced this, who's experienced living as a deceitful person, knows that it's not a pleasant way to live. I speak from experience on this. One very major aspect as to why that is because you're always worried that you're going to be caught up. In your conscience is always the niggling suspicion or that somebody's going to find out that I lied, right? That I didn't tell the truth. And that's just no way to live. That's a very, very unpleasant way to live. So, especially in this bigger cases, he's talking about kind of some serious consequences. It has been said that a person who intends to give something, even a very small thing, but nevertheless does not give it, will become a craving spirit, a preta, what they call a preta. So he's now here. This is an example of what they call karmic correlations in some of these texts. And you can believe it or not. You can take it literally, or you can think about it more metaphysically, more metaphorically. But what he's saying here is that if you promise to give something to someone and you don't deliver on it, you will become a kind of a person that's always craving and never satisfied. You will become a kind of a being, and one form of that being who's always craving and never satisfied is an addict, an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever you're addicted to. That's that karma, actually. It comes from not following through on your words and not being satisfied with what you have. No. So, caution. High risk, high gain here. These verses are on high risk, high gain. Yeah, potentially a very high gain for making this kind of awesome commitment and turn of the mind, a transformation of the mind to take on this bodhicitta thing. But the consequences of not following through on that are equally high. That's what he said. So what about someone who lies so ostentatiously? So this verse was just about somebody oh, Denise, I'll get you a coffee, and then you space out or decide that you can't afford it and you don't give her a coffee. You might end up as a preta. What about somebody who has lies so ostentatiously? The Sanskrit means loudly, literally. Who loudly declares in a formal ceremony here at Mahasukha with a whole bunch of people who've come to watch in front of the vow giver and who's calling up all kinds of cosmic powers, please come all Buddhas in all directions, loudly and ostentatiously lies. Takes a vow that they don't intend to try to fulfill, to keep. Inviting the whole world to the highest happiness, what then would be my fate, you see? Yeah. Only someone who was omniscient, sarva-jna. Sarva means all. Jna means know everything. This is verse 7, right? Only someone who is omniscient could know the inscrutable way, achintya. Achintya means you can't think it. Can't think this. Unthinkable, imponderable. Only someone who was omniscient could know the inscrutable way karma could unfold, such that even people who give up the wish to awaken could nevertheless attain liberation. So this is an interesting verse on different levels. So I'll stall out here just a little bit, if you don't mind. One second. He's saying here, actually, theoretically, it is possible that someone who took the vow of the Bodhisattva, who made that commitment, and then reneged on it, could still get into enlightenment, could still get to liberation. Theoretically. But it's achitya. It's unthinkable. It's unthinkable to anyone other than maybe a Buddha. In other words, none of us could figure it out. How that could possibly happen. That if you made a commitment like this and then like said, ah, to hell with it. How you would ever reach the highest goals of the spiritual path. So that's one level in which he's talking. That's a very sort of like literal level of what he's saying here, actually. But it's interesting, I wanted to stall out on this. The reason I wanted to stall out on it is because of the combination of inscrutable and karma. Because karma is inscrutable, actually. And this is a standard teaching in the Indian traditions. That karma is what they call in Tibetan, in the English translation of Tibetan, very hidden. This is a translation of a previous Sanskrit word, paroksha. Paroksha means you can't see it. You can't see how karma unfolds, actually. Okay? And so we all, when we talk about karma and how to create good karma and stuff like that, we are talking in the most broad, general, strokes. We're painting it with the most broad and general strokes. The actual events, karmic events in our lives, are unknown to us. And that's why it kind of comes to the same thing. This is kind of an interesting thing for people who think they believe in karma. It kind of comes to the same thing as people who just believe in fate. Because karma ripens in completely unknowable ways for us. Can't know it. Achintya means you can't think it. You can't trace it. You see? If you harm somebody, negative things will come to you. But which negative things at which time, you never know. How's that? If you do positive things to people, positive things will come, but you can't say when and you can't say in what package. Okay? So that's a kind of like harkens back a little bit to the talk on Friday night. It's not about like, I'll do X so that I'll get Y. This is not the teaching on karma. This is not the teaching on karma. You can't know that you're going to get Y out of X, actually. You do X because it's a good thing to do and whatever Y that comes will be fine. You see? No. Y will be good no matter what it is. In a way, if karma worked differently than that, we would be perpetually unsurprised. We would be perpetually, like, complacent. Oh, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. Yeah, I created the karma for that last week. Oh, no. Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Check. Next one. Right? All the mystery and surprise of life would go out of it. If karma worked the way we kind of like usually hope and think it does, but it doesn't work at that level. It is very hidden, paroksha, very hidden. It is atyanta. Beyond limit means beyond limit, beyond the limits of the mind on how karma, in its details works out. So the best we can do when it comes to karma is to just say, if I do good, something good will come. Because that is a karmic principle. So what good brings good. And not just maybe or sometimes or hopefully, but for sure. But when and in what form is beyond our ken? Beyond our ken. So just give it up already. Just relax. See? Relax about the whole expectation thing. Expectations, as I said on Friday night, for those of you who are here or weren't here, I'll say it again for those of you who weren't here. Expectation is a disappointment in training. You know, when we have these expectations, they have you noticed through life? Almost always are not met. At least in the kind of form that we thought they would be, you see? Almost always. You can't predict the future. And if you could predict the future, you'd be a really unhappy person, actually. It's part of the joy of life that the future is unpredictable. It's what living is. It's the joy that we have of living, of dealing with whatever wave comes our way. Not to say, I want a wave machine. You know, it's like the difference in surfing. It's like the difference between a real wave in the ocean and going to like one of those Disneyland things where they just got one, same wave, over and over and over again. You know, it's not fun. Repetitious. It's obvious. It's, you know, it's dull. So think about that. I mean, we all have this kind of like desire to control things, don't we? I mean, first of all, it's an illusion that you can control things. In the immediate moment, in the way that karma ripens, everything is out of our control. The grand scheme of things is in our control. If you do good, good will come. But the details are out of our control. So this, first of all, it's an illusion that we can control things. And second of all, we'd be very, very disappointed, actually, if we could control things. The only thing worse than not getting what you want is getting what you do want. In this case, is a perfect example of it. If we could control, micromanage the universe, micromanage our lives, we'd be very bored. Very, very bored. Nothing new. Oh yeah, this is going to happen. Nothing, you know, awestruck. You would never be awestruck. Oh, I didn't know that was going to, You know. We'd kind of like to, you know, the ultimate micromanaging would be to just have like cool stuff, unexpected cool stuff happen, but never unexpected bad stuff happen. But you can't work it that way, you see? If it's going to be unexpected, it's going to be sometimes what you thought or hoped for or, you know, is awesome, and sometimes it's going to be, wait, I didn't really want that to happen. And here's the ultimate goal, okay? The ultimate goal is to be awestruck about it all. No matter what happens. You see, to say, oh, another awesome wave. You see, I didn't plan that wave. In many ways, you can't, in all waves you can't plan. But in many ways, you can say, I didn't plan that, and I wouldn't have planned that. But sometimes the great cosmic forces at work are way better planners than you are. You see, sometimes we get these unexpected and unwanted waves, experiences, that turn out to be just exactly the right thing. Yeah, and you kind of only realize that usually retroactively. So think about, you know, this karma thing is important to think about, okay? Really important to think about. How does karma really work? And how much control do you think you have? You know, we kind of bring a secular idea of the control of the universe. You know, Captain Kirk's self, trying to micromanage everything at work and, you know, with our finances and all like that. And we kind of bring that into our spiritual lives. And then think, oh, I'll do the same thing that I've always been trying to do out there. You know, control everything. You know, only I'll call it karma now. And, you know, and I'll put on some sitar music and, you know, have some prayer flags. And it's exactly the same thing. It's selfish grasping. It's egotistical desire. I want this and I don't want that. That is not the goal to happiness. No matter what you call it. You can call it going to work or you can call it karma, but that's not the goal to happiness. Do good because good is good to do. Not for what you think you're going to get out of it or what you expect to get out of it. Virtue is its own reward. And it truly is. See? It's not some, you know, magical, mystical trick of having to, like, think differently. When you do good, you feel good. Isn't it? Yeah. And so then just relax about what's going to happen in life. You can't control life. What you can control is your response to life. That's in your control. You know, you can discipline yourself to respond happily, contentedly, and properly to no matter what life brings you, no matter which wave you're dealing with. But you can't control the waves. It's naive at best, okay? And many people go through their whole lives in a spiritual context, thinking that the whole point is to try to you know, have that sort of new and improved Captain Kirk self at play. Only now, with the cool, you know, new methods, karma or prayer, people sometimes use the same thing. Oh, if I pray to God, then my auntie will get healed. You know, my sick auntie. And, you know, if you're paying attention, you can't really maintain that very long. You can't maintain that. If I give money, I will have so much money in the bank later. You know, you have like some kind of like vague figure on what your sort of savings account is going to be like. And, you know, you're going to be disappointed. 9 times out of 10, if that's the way you think karma works, or if that's the way you think prayer works. You see, it doesn't work like that. It doesn't change the externals. It changes the internals. It changes your perspective. It changes your vision. It changes your attitude. It doesn't change necessarily the waves. Can't change the waves. Change you. Maybe you can change the waves, but Achintya, I can't tell you how. The texts say, unless you're a Buddha, you actually don't know how karma works in its details. So I'm not going to sit up here and tell you that if you give money, you will have $100,000 in the bank next year. I'm setting myself up for major discredit if I start, you know, teaching stuff like that. You know, and people do it. I grew up with faith healers, you know, who usually did this. And of course, they're always an out. You know, faith healers, for those of you who don't know, they say, you know, come and with your faith in Jesus Christ, the Lord, you know, I'll make you walk again. You see, these are the poor, crippled people come up, and then, you know, 9 times out of 10, they go back with their crutches. Once in a while, you know, see, this is the thing. Once in a while, it's like mind over matter or whatever happens, right? And they go, I can walk again. And then you got, like, the big success story. But 9 times out of 10, they hobble back to their seats. And you know what they say then? What does the faith healer say then? Not enough faith. And you can say the same thing. If I tell you, you start donating to the Mahasukha Center, and in a year's time, you will have $100,000 in your bank account. You know, and you come back in a year later, you start donating to the Mahasukha Center, a year later you come back and say, like, I only have $10,000, or I'm in debt, or whatever. You know? Well, I could say, well, you didn't do the karma right. You didn't give enough, or you didn't give it with the right attitude, or you didn't give it with enough, you know, full intention, or blah, 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 blah. So it's setting people up, really, for disappointment, both the people who are practicing it and the people who are teaching it that way. You say, you know, you're setting yourself up. Think about karma more sophisticatedly. This is the way that you teach karma to children, actually. You teach children, you know, share your toys. If you want Johnny to share his toy with you, you share your toy with Johnny. And that's teaching karma like that is just a, you know, fancier version of share your toys with Johnny. It's just what we teach children. It's not like thinking about how the world's working. You know, investigating, you know, thinking at a deeper level as to, you know, what is cause and effect and how does it work? It works on you. It doesn't work on the world out there. The world out there actually is explained causally much better by science than by karma. Science has done, I'll put it like this. Karma as an explanatory system for how the world works, as a metaphysical sort of system of explanation of how things work, is for pre-scientific societies. Because they didn't have science. They didn't know how stuff happened scientifically. So, you know, karma was applied to there. It's inappropriate, inapplicable here in our time and place to think that, you know, stuff out there happens because of karma. Stuff in here certainly happens because of karma. Okay? And scientists have not disproven that at all. If you ask, you know, a neuroscientist or a psychologist or something like that, why long enough? See, why am I depressed? Why? You know, they don't have an answer, ultimately. They say, well, you know, you've had a trauma. Well, lots of people have traumas and didn't get depressed. Or you have genetic disposition towards depression. Well, a lot of people come with it, and they never, like, it never, like, manifests, you see. Why? Why me? And then you can explain through karma. Why do I have the perceptions that I have of myself and therefore of the world around me? Because we see the world as we are, not as it is, right? We see the world through our own spectacles. And at that level, karma is true. That is how karma really does work. But to think that, you know, to think that karma can influence the material world in a direct and immediate way is just magic. It's just belief in magic. And we're not a magical society. We're a post-magical society, okay? We got science. Science explains a lot of stuff for us. And to explain it otherwise, I think in a scientific, in a post, you know, kind of magical society that we are in, is, you know, is designed to bring people some disbelief, I think. You know, eventually. Sometimes sooner rather than later. Okay, enough of that. Truly is the greatest downfall of only someone who is dominant. Truly, verse 8, that is the greatest downfall of them all, gravest downfall of them all for a bodhisattva, since by bringing this about, one damages the welfare of all living beings. So, you know, what is he talking about here, remember? Reneging on your promise, right? And it's kind of an interesting phrase, because it damages the welfare of all living beings. How can my action, you know, my negative action, you know, say I'm a bodhisattva, how can that damage all living beings? Who are you as a bodhisattva? See, you've changed your conception of I. So, of course it would damage all living beings, because you have identified with all living beings. There is no end to the misfortune of a person who obstructs a bodhisattva's merit-making, even for just an instant, for he destroys the welfare of all living beings again. So a bodhisattva is somebody who is not the same kind of a person as somebody who's not a bodhisattva. Because if the self is just a self-conception, they have conceptualized themselves quite differently than the way we do. So to damage a bodhisattva is to damage all living beings. For a bodhisattva to renege on their promises is to damage all living beings. High gain, high risk. Yep. One who harms the benefactor of just one single being is himself harmed. How much more someone who harms the benefactor of all beings dwelling throughout the entirety of endless space? So you see, that's who the bodhisattva is. Caught in samsara, oscillating between the power of the downfalls. Pati is a technical term in monastic language. As a downfall is a breaking of a monastic vow, but here I think it means vows in general. Okay. A downfall is a breaking of a vow in general, and you can even say because of what's coming. It's the power, bola, of the kleshas, the mental afflictions. So, caught in samsara, oscillating between two forces. What? The forces of the mental afflictions, and the forces, the power, the bola, of bodhicitta. One is slow to obtain the various levels of a bodhisattva. These are reference to the bhumis, the 10 bhumis, the 10 different, like, you know, sort of stages of life as a bodhisattva. So this is another one in which, you know, kind of, he's pointing to a general fact of life, of human life, is that we wrestle with two different inner powers all the time. We wrestle. The kleshas are by definition selfish. Kleshas, anger, jealousy, envy, desire, over-desire, lust-like. See, even doubt, bad doubt. We were talking about doubt the other night. Bad doubt means irresolution, not just not coming to a conclusion on stuff. These are the things that are driving us crazy, and they drive us crazy because we're in this taking the center stage. See, I'm angry. I'm jealous. I want this new watch. I. So there's that power in us, and then there's this other power, the power, the angel power, the power of good, the power that knows that we are happiest when we feel connected to other beings, when we lose ourselves in service and love and compassion with others. So this is the inner war. I call it the big smackdown. You know, like in professional wrestling, Rage in the Cage. Everyone watch that stuff? I grew up on that stuff. And it's the big internal smackdown between the angel and the devil. And the spiritual practitioner is empowering the angel with whatever kind of weaponry is necessary. You know, just like in the wrestling matches, they smuggle in all kinds of illegal weapons. They got blackjacks in their trunks, and they got brass knuckles, and whatever. And there's a spiritual version of that, as we'll see, of smuggling in whatever you need. See, by any means necessary, like Malcolm X said, by whatever means necessary, we are going to bring this devil down. And it's a big smackdown. The devil is very empowered already. We've been empowering the devil for our whole lifetimes. So the devil got all kinds of like tricks up his sleeve too, her sleeve. So we got to like fight fire with fire. You know, sometimes people get the wrong idea about a spiritual life, and they say, especially with me, they say like, you're kind of loud, you don't talk like you're supposed to talk. You're supposed to just kind of like be like this. Yes, and nice, and kind, like look vague all the time. Wear Birkenstocks. Have a nice day, and all of that. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of attitude as long as there's an inner fire. There has to be an inner fire. You have to have a warrior attitude as a spiritual practitioner. There's nothing namby-pamby about an authentic spiritual practitioner, because the war is brutal. And if you don't come to it with a lot of power and force, inner words, you're going to lose over and over and over, because the devil is so strong, the inner devil. One who harms a benefactor. Okay, we did that. Caught in samsara, we did that one. So I must conscientiously fulfill that to which I have committed. If I don't make an effort now, I will sink lower and lower. You're either on an upward cycle or a downward cycle. Innumerable Buddhas have come and gone, wishing to round up all living beings. I'm also proud of this translation. It is my fault that I have not come in range of their attention. The word I've translated is round up. Like the big Western roundup? The Buddhas have come to try to round us all up, Gava Isha is literally means seeking the cattle, seeking the cows, going looking for the cows. And then the word for range is gochara. Go means cow also. Gochara means the range of the cows. Where the cows, the deer and the buffalo roam, where the cows roam. And it came in general to mean any kind of range where things, activities occur. If I say like this, as I am now, I will repeatedly suffer bad rebirths, sickness, death, mutilation, laceration, and so forth. These are all like, the various hells that you could experience in Tibetan Buddhist cosmology. So now, this part of the text then says, look, in order to protect, to be vigilant about, this little germ of bodhicitta that I have to go back to the basics. Go back to the foundation. What are the foundations? There are two, basically. Death and leisure and fortune. Death and leisure and fortune. Well, I'll put it positive. Leisure and fortune and death. Leisure and fortune means to recognize what an amazing deal you got in this life and to not space out on it. And then, of course, death means to realize it's not going to last forever. So I have to be careful. I have to make the most of it. Vigilance again, right? When will I attain what is so difficult, so very hard to obtain? Ati dur labha. Labha means obtain. Dur means hard. Ati means like over the top hard. Really hard. The appearance of, when will I gain what is so very hard to obtain? What is hard to obtain? The appearance of a Buddha. Having connection to a teacher, a spiritual teacher who has taught the truth. You don't have to call him a Buddha. You can call him Jesus. You can call him whatever. But some connection to to the truth, to the spiritual truth. Faith. Recognizing that it is the truth. Some shraddha, they call it in Sanskrit. And birth as a human being, which is the best of all possible births, because it's got the perfect mixture of suffering and happiness. Suffering and relief from, tremendous suffering. It's got the perfect balance like that. Life is today and the ability to practice making merit. So, you know, what a great deal I got here. When am I going to get that again? Today there may be health, enjoyment, and no problems, but life is fleeting and deceptive. Deceptive means it doesn't look like it's fleeting. It looks like I'll be here forever. I woke up yesterday, I'm going to wake up tomorrow. Right? We just think like, well, it will just go on forever somehow, unchanged. Especially like, you know, if you're having a pretty good thing going now. You got a good job, you got good relationships, you got a nice house, you got a nice education. It'll always be this way somehow. And it won't be this way forever for any individual, and it won't be this way for any culture, for any society. So Americans especially got to get their heads around the fact of change. You know? It's not going to, you know, it's not going to be like it has always been. And, you know, it could go better, it could go worse, but it's not going to stay the same. Nothing stays the same. With behavior such as mine, I'll not obtain a human birth. When one doesn't get such a human birth, there are only bad deeds. So when you're in, like, some really terrible situation, you know, never mind hell realms and stuff like that. When push comes to shove, like when there's not enough oil, when there's not enough food, when there's not enough heating, when there are not enough resources, people revert back to the jungle life, to just like savagery. And that can happen very quickly. That does happen very quickly. That happened to the Germans, you know, in between World War I and II. It happens to, you know, to civilized, highly educated, you know, cultured societies. It can happen very quickly. Remember the oil shortage? When was that? In the 1970s. People were shooting each other for gas at the gas stations. You know? It can happen. It can happen very quickly. So, with behavior like mine, you know, if I'm not, like, careful, you know, I could end up in a realm like that. If I don't do meritorious action while I'm capable of it, because now I am capable of it. Now nobody is shooting me for gasoline. Now nobody is bombing my cities. Now nobody is, like, you know, lining up for bread at the, you know, at the bread lines. If I don't do meritorious action while I'm capable of it, what will I do when I'm completely stupefied by the sufferings of the unfortunate states? You know, if you can't practice it now, do you think it's going to get easier to practice when chips are really down? See, now it's just like cushy, easy. What about if when it gets harder? How do you think it'll be easier then to get going? One who does not do meritorious action and instead accumulates bad deeds will have destroyed his chances to even hear the word good birth for hundreds of millions of eons. He's getting like a little fire and brimstone now. That is why the Blessed One, that's the Buddha again, said, this is a very famous verse, okay? A human birth is very hard to obtain. He's not talking about your life. He's talking about any human life. Your version of a human life is off the scales here. He's just talking about getting born as a human instead of an insect or, you know, a Martian. A human birth is very hard to obtain, as rare as a turtle who just happens to stick its neck into the opening of a yolk floating in the great sea. Turtle, underwater turtle, who can't see above, he's not aiming for the yolk, okay? That's not the image here. Just happens to, like, rise and happens to put its head through a floating yolk. That's about the odds, they say here, of getting a birth like this. Getting it, and you know, and Shanti Dev is writing in 800, 700 AD in a third world country. You know, pre-modern third world country, no electricity, no running water, let alone, you know, SUVs and iPods and, you know, all the other stuff we have. And it's like, oh yeah, it's so awesome here. It's so awesome here in the dirt, you know, living in a hut in the dirt with no running water. I have to go get, you know, no indoor plumbing. So rare to get a life like this. What about our lives? Can't even, like, you know, I often fantasize about, like, bringing somebody like Shanti Deva into our life and, like, what verse would you write then, you know? Like, if you're writing verses like this for, you know, your, like, pre-modern, you know, poverty-stricken third world countries, what verse would you write for the life we're leading, you know? Yep. Oh, they added that later, you know, just to make it like even more awesome. Yeah. Because of a bad deed, done in just one moment. One goes to the Avicii hell. Avicii hell is the hell of unremitting pain. That's what Avicii means, unremitting. Because of a bad deed done in just one moment, one goes to the Avicii hell for an eon. So how on earth will I land a good rebirth with bad deeds accumulated since beginningless time, like I have? So again, a little fire and brimstone. By the way, this is also just a kind of an oblique reference to another principle of karma, and that is karma grows. Karma increases. So he says, even just a bad deed done in just one moment, you know, could land you up into a hell realm, which, you know, sounds like totally unfair. Doesn't it? You know, you go like, oh, come on. But what he's, you know, the principle here is that, we'll take a bad deed first, is that when you have a bad thought or say something nasty to someone or do something harmful to someone, if you don't regret it, if you don't say, I shouldn't have done that, I'm sorry I did that, it was stupid of me, and if you just kind of own it and you say, yeah, I did that, and it becomes part of you, you see? It defines you. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger as a part of who you are because you've empowered it. You've empowered it by identifying with it, by embracing it, by owning it and saying, yeah, that's the kind of person I am. I'm the person that when somebody says something nasty to me, I just say the nastiest thing back I can think of. You see how it could grow like that? As part of your personality, you could say. Similarly, a good deed, something, and even just little ones, even just a little good deed can also grow, does also grow, especially if you recall it, if you deepen the groove, the mental groove that it's found by rehearsing it, by rejoicing about it, by going through it, remembering it over and over again, because then it becomes, again, more and more and more a part of your very being, of who you think you are as a person, you see? So karma does grow. But it's not out there and going, you know? It grows inside of us. It grows as part of ourselves, both positively and negatively. So one way to make the bad deed, of course, stop growing is to regret it and to just say, like, no, I don't want to be that kind of a person. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to own up to it, but I'm not going to own it. How's that? I'll own up to it. I have to own up to my negative deeds. But I'm not going to, like, be that. And then to increase the growth rate of the good deeds is to rejoice in it and to remember it and to rehearse it and to, you know, like, just lie there. Just sit there in your, you know, easy chair and go, ah, oh, yeah, at least I did that right. You know, over and over and over again. Having experienced even that, one is still not free. Having, you know, like, maybe even gone to a hell realm. For one has created new bad deeds while being in that experience for reasons I just talked about. Like when you're in these kind of extreme situations, you know, you're not... It's really rare and hard to do anything other than just survive. Which means that, you know, again, kind of... In India, they call it the law of the fishes. Big fish eat little fish. Law of the jungle, we call it, right? When you're in these kind of extreme situations, you're not creating good karma. You know. And so, having obtained a momentary opportunity like this, kshana means just a brief moment in the great scheme of things, in the great cosmic scheme of things, a life like this is a flash in the pan. So, having obtained a momentary opportunity like this, were I not to use it to practice virtue, there would be no greater betrayal, no greater foolishness. The word is hard to... I translated it as betrayal, but it really means kind of a theft. I stole something that didn't really belong to me. I lived a life that was an amazing gift and just, you know, used it up for my own purposes. It wasn't given to you for that reason. You see, you kind of stole it. If you don't use it for the purpose that it was brought to you by you, by the way, if you don't use it to really try to, like, go for it spiritually, then you kind of, like, have stolen your own life in a way. And if I am again neglectful and just stupidly sit on my hands, when the messengers of death come calling, I will regret it for a long, long time. Two ways to die. We're all going to die. Everyone okay with that? We're all going to definitely die. And there's two ways to die, basically. You can die with regret or you can die saying, and here's your mantra for today. And you gotta, this is a mantra that you gotta kind of live up to. Say Om.
Om.
I'm
doing
my best.
My best.
And you start living Om. And you start living your life like that, and when you die, you can say, Om, I have done my best. And that's a good way to die. There's two ways to die. Which one you want to die? How, which way do you want to go? And you go, and so, that's all we can do, by the way, isn't it? Is our best. Right? You just do your best. But only you know what your best is. Okay? So you're your own judge on like whether or not you're, you know, whether or not you can say that mantra honestly. I'm doing my best. The unbearable fires of hell will scorch my body, blah, blah. Regret. Verse 26. Somehow I've achieved a fortunate state, so hard to obtain, and even knowing this, I find myself attracted again to the hell realms. You know, what is he talking about here? He's talking about our attraction to the causes that would bring us more unhappiness. Again, the inner war. We're constantly at war with ourselves. We know kind of everyone, like, you know, who comes to a thing like this, a place like this, probably has heard, not for the first time, anything much new today. We know what we, how we're supposed to live. We know that it's, you know, important to live a life of honesty and goodness and, you know, compassion and love and all like that. We know this. We've heard it many, many times in many, many forms. We know this. But then there's this other whole big part of us that says, oh, the hell with that. Especially when it's inconvenient. Of course it's, of course we are very, very nice people when it's convenient. You know, when it's easy. It's, when it's easy to be nice, we're nice. You, and you kind of don't get much credit for that, really. You know? You get real credit by being a good person when it's hard to be a good person. When someone's insulting you. When somebody's sending you really nasty emails. When somebody's threatening you, you see? Then it's really hard to kind of just like say, okay, I'm just going to hold the fort here, hold the position, and not give in to my worst inclinations. That's the inner battle right there. And you can think of your whole spiritual life as like strengthening the angel for when it comes time for showtime. And showtime will come before you know it. Quickly, showtime's come, you know, pretty much every minute in the way is showtime. But especially when it's hard, you know? And it's hard. And no matter how long you practice, I mean, it's my experience anyway. You can practice for, you know, 2 months. You can practice for 5 years. You can practice for 15 years. Maybe, I don't know any much more than that, but I expect that if I live long enough, I'll practice until the day I die and have challenging situations all the way up to my deathbed. They're not going to go away, you see? You're not going to ever not have provocation or like difficulties with other people or something like that. So if you're practicing spirituality for some kind of like change in the waves that are coming at you so that only the nice ones come. Only the ones that are perfectly shaped and are breaking to the right, because you're a right-hand brick, you know. You know, that's just unrealistic. You practice to be able to surf whatever wave comes, whether it's ill-shaped or nicely shaped, whether it's breaking this way or that way. Yeah, that's the goal. The goal is not to never have anything unwanted and unpleasant ever happen to you again. The goal is knowing how to deal with it happily, contentedly, skillfully. Okay? And that's hard work. Enemies like, I have no, then this next verse, I talked about it on Friday, so I won't linger too long. If it's like I have no other choice in the matter, no choice in the matter, as if bewitched by mantras. I don't know who has confused me. I don't know who is there inside me. I just love this verse because it feels that way, doesn't it? I used to call it, before I started practicing, I used to call it a trash syndrome. I certainly had a trash syndrome. As soon as things started going too well, I'd trash it, you know? Because I kind of thrived on, like, chaos, you know? One reason for that is it was an excuse to drink more, you know? When things were really chaotic, well, I got to have a drink, you know, got to have some drugs or whatever. It gave me like an excuse. But we're all kind of like that, you know? In one form or another, we all kind of like systematically tend to disrupt our own happiness. You know, as soon as like, you know, things start going well, you know, we create the causes for things to go bad again, you know, because we're addicted to that. We're addicted to selfishness. We're addicted to difficulties and problems. We have a case of what I call Lieberphobia. We're afraid of being free. We like being in our little cages, all like shackled up in our mental afflictions and our anger and our, because we have defined ourselves that way. That's the I that we're holding on to. That's the I that we cherish. That's my snowflake self. Who would I be if I weren't angry? Well, you'd be happy. You wouldn't be you, because you wouldn't be angry. You'd be someone else. Well, I don't want to be, I'm myself and myself alone. See, right? That's grasping to self. And grasping to our habits that define ourselves that way. And so, again, the inner war. The inner war really, I think nowadays, is a war about identity. Who you want to be? Do you want to be the you that you identify with that's defined by your mental afflictions? You know, you are your mental afflictions, you could say. You are the sum total of all your anger and jealousy and envy and aggravatingness and all of that, irritation. You're the sum, that's who you are. That's who we all are. Or do you want to be like somebody that you don't know who it is because you've never been that? See, are you willing to take the leap? Are you willing to let go of the caterpillar in order to be a butterfly? But we resist it because we've never been butterflies. I don't know. You know, who would I be if I weren't me? And, you know, you can start answering that question like, happy. You'd be a happy person. You wouldn't be you, all right, because you are an unhappy person. If you're a happy person, you wouldn't be you. But that's okay, you'd be happy. So it's a kind of like a willingness to die. It's a kind of a willingness to just like fall on the sword and say, okay, I've had enough with this kind of me, and I don't have any expectations that this kind of me is going to radically change anytime in the future. So, you know, so why not be someone else? Why not let go of the me that I'm holding on to and see what it's like to be nobody? See what it's like to be identity-less, to let go of the self. And again, that's helped a great deal by remembering how happy you are when you experience that. When you're in the zone, when you're in the flow, when you're in this kind of like mindful, unself-conscious experience is when we are happiest. And wouldn't that be nice to have that as kind of your real self, you see, identifying as that. But that's not a somebody self, right? That's not a snowflake individual self. That's an indescribable self. That's a self without qualities, without kind of characteristics or qualities or individuality. We're all really nobody, and we're all nobody in exactly the same way. That's our true nature. That's the ocean, and then the waves come. And we say, no, I don't want to be the ocean. I want to be a wave. Where am I? And then he's like, so now he's going, so, you know, like, how come this, the devil's in me, you know? What causes that? And just like in the Bhagavad Gita, he gives a, you know, they give the same kind of answer. Enemies like craving and hatred. There they are. That's who's causing it. Your mental afflictions, especially the main ones here. Craving means wanting something I don't have. And hatred means not wanting something I do have. It's as simple as that. That's what those two mean. The two forms of dissatisfaction with what is. I want something other than what is right now, here, in my life, in myself, and I don't want something that is here. Craving and rejection, you could say. Stationed within my own minds, they are perfectly situated to destroy me. You see, if they were out there somewhere, if they were living in Oregon or something, you know, then maybe you could evade them. Like, you know, you could like dodge them when they came into California. Like, but they live right inside of us all the time. And yet I don't get, station within my mind, and yet I don't get angry. And so here's a, like, this is not that loose of a translation, okay? It really means this. To hell with this inappropriate patience. Usually I go, wait a minute, patience? I thought I was supposed to be patient. And Shantideva goes, no, not with your mental afflictions. Don't be patient with your enemies. You don't, now we go into militaristic language in this text. These are your enemies, and let's get to war on them. Okay? No more patience, no more trying to negotiate, no more like playing footsies under the table. You know, like you go out with like, you know, some new guy or some new girl, and you know, like you're mental afflictions are like that. And you know, you have nice dinner and you start playing footsies under there, like hoping it'll lead to something bigger. Like maybe you could take them home and like have a nice relationship with your anger or your jealousy or your envy or your desire. See, we're playing footsies with them. We're mollycoddling them. I like that word. Mollycoddling. We're excusing them. I couldn't help it. They're the best part of me somehow. They're part of my personality. We make all kinds of rationalizations and excuses for them. And that won't get rid of them. That's not how you defeat them. Station with my mind. So, all of that. Even if every one of the gods and humans were my enemies, they would still not be able to drag me down into the fires of Avicii Hell. No outside force can cause you to do bad. No outside force can cause you to do good, for that matter. It's all coming from within. No matter if all the gods, he says, all the gods and every human being like allied themselves against me, they couldn't cause me to fall from my virtue. The only thing that can cause me to fall from my virtue is the enemies within. Not outside forces. So this is a worst case scenario too, by the way. Wouldn't that be a drag to have all the gods and humans like be against you? Which when encountered could burn even Mount Meru to ashes. But the powerful and mental affliction enemies cast me into them directly, instantly. The Klesha Shatrus, the mental affliction enemies. None of my other enemies have such long life. You know? Osama bin Laden, before he was murdered, he would have died anyway, right? Eventually, right? You could wait him out, you know. But your mental afflictions aren't going to just die like that. They got legs. You know that expression? They got legs. They're not just going to like disappear from old age. None of my other enemies have such a long life without beginning or end. Yeah, that's kind of what he says. Like the longevity of my mental affliction foes. Everyone, when treated with kindness, becomes affable. You know, when you have a human enemy, if you treat them with kindness, you know, he's a little hopeful here, but oftentimes they can't quite get it up to be as nasty to you as they used to be. You know, if you like systematically just like don't engage and don't rise to the bait and stuff like that, you know, over time things do tend to change, you know? Not with your mental afflictions, you see. Don't be nice to them. They're not going to change because you're nice to them. It just strengthens them. But when these mental afflictions are honored, they bring about even more suffering. They see, oh, the door is open now. Now they've opened the door. So let's rush in. When these long-lasting enemies, who are the one and only cause of a flood of disasters, live so fearlessly in my heart. Why do they live fearlessly there? Near Baya. Why? Because you're not fighting them. You're just letting them have your way. And you're honoring them maybe even. Oh, you know, my anger is the best part. It's a fire in my belly. You know? It's the best part of me somehow. You see? Then they just get stronger. Where are we? Which one? 35. If these prison guards of existence, this is a nice kind of reference to, metaphor for the mental afflictions. They are the guards that keep us in jail. They keep us in samsara, the jail of samsara. These executioners and killers who live in places like the hell realms dwell in the very house of my very mind. in the house of my very mind. They're right here. They're very intimate. In the cage of my own greed. How can I be happy? Can't be happy and have mental afflictions at the same time. Somebody's got to go. For as long as these enemies... Does your translation say long or a long? A long should be long. For as long as these enemies are not struck down right before my eyes, I will not drop this burden I'm carrying. Proud people engaged with an offender do not sleep until they destroy him, no matter how trivial the offense. And I was talking about real warriors here a little bit. You know, somebody like this is a real warrior. They don't sleep night and day until they get their revenge. And he's saying, why don't you treat your real enemies that way? Why so complacent? Why so lazy? Why so postponing and procrastinating and or even like inviting and engaging and, you know, giving them succor? See, why don't you treat them like the enemies they are? If you had a real enemy, if you were a warrior, you would not sleep night and day. You would be, you know, out for them to get them. Yeah? In the heat of the battle, fierce warriors are able to swiftly kill those who, ignorant and unhappy, will die anyway. You know, this is actually the best way to conduct a war, is to just go and stand in front of your enemy and wait until they die. They will die for sure, eventually, right? Just wait them out. You know? So you're going to kill people that are going to die anyway. These are the physical enemies that we supposedly have. You're going to kill people who die enemy, that will die anyway. Although tormented by countless wounds from arrows and spears, a warrior does not turn away until they've accomplished their goals. They take a lot of hit. They put up with a lot of pain. Yeah? Even today, when you're just like fighting mostly by drones, you know, the soldiers in the Middle East and other places like that put up with a lot of hardship. You know, a lot of hardship to be there. So he said, why don't you be willing to put up with that same hardship for your real enemies? He's trying to get stoked up. Just trying to get us, you know, kind of really motivated here. When I am intent on slaying my congenital enemies, it means the enemies that you have by birth. Prakriti. Prakriti means natural. That's why I translated congenital. They're part of our, you know, kind of our constitution. When I am intent on slaying my congenital enemies, the causes of all my continuous suffering. Why am I now depressed and dejected? Why am I such a wuss? Yeah. Even if I must put up with hundreds of difficulties. So, you know, like, if you really get serious about fighting your own mental affliction, whatever it is, or sets of them, especially the big ones, you know, you might think, well, it's too hard. I've always had this problem with anger, and, you know, it's just going to be, you know, too hard. I can't help it, and blah, blah, blah. Why feel like that? Why feel so dejected, you know? Get going, get busy, be brave, be a warrior. Right? Get up, stand up. Yeah. And get going. Don't wuss out like this. Some people wear the wounds they receive for no good reason from their enemies as if they were ornaments on their body. I imagine in ancient times where they, you know, they fought battles in kind of like nasty ways with knives and swords and, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, guys would come back with all kinds of scars and stuff. And that probably was some kind of badge of honor, you know? They kind of like, you see what happened here? Oh, that was when that guy like ripped me open with the sword, you know? So people are showing off these wounds as if they were like ornaments on their bodies. So why do sufferings bother me who am intent on accomplishing such a great goal? So yeah, it's going to hurt. It's going to cause pain. You're going to take hits by in this battle. But, you know, then you can really show your, you know, war wounds, you see? You can really show off. Yeah, you know, I went through a really difficult time fighting my anger, and, you know, damn, I'm proud. I got through it, you know, like that. People like fishermen, outcasts, and farmers, grips, personal assistants to the director, screenplay writers, film editors, put up with all kinds of adversities. Like cold and heat and the rest, or like getting enough sleep and unbelievable commutes and, you know, working with people who are not that pleasant to work with just to make a living, you know, just for the money. So why can't I also beat hardships If it's for the sake of the welfare of the whole world, you see, so much more at stake here than just like your career or your paycheck, which we do put. So he's saying, you know, we do put up with all kinds of hardships for money and for fame, really, for money and for career advancement. But so we're perfectly capable of putting up with hardships. So why not put up for the hardships for the real battle, the battle within, the battle internal? Although I have committed to liberating from their mental afflictions living beings extending through space in all directions, blah, 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 that's what you said in your Bodhisattva vows, I have not even managed to free even myself from such afflictions. So this is a kind of an interesting admission of hypocrisy. That if you have sworn to, you know, to help and save all other sentient beings before you fixed yourself, you're a little bit of a hypocrite. You can't help anybody else until you've helped yourself. You can't save drowning people if you don't know how to swim. Right? So you have, as a bodhisattva requirement, mandate, to fix yourself first. To learn how to live a happy life yourself first. So don't think that that's selfish, you see. If it's done with the motivation, because I got to help others. You know, how can I help others if I don't know how to do it myself? If that's your motivation, then get going on yourself. Fix the mental afflictions. This is a whole chapter on, like, fixing your own problems before you start, like, monkeying around with other people's problems. It's like a brain surgeon going around, you know, can I open your head and do brain surgery? Well, do you have an MD? No. No, I just would like to try, you know, see if I could do some good there, mucking around in your brain. Not really knowing myself. I was a crazy person who spoke them words, you know, the vows. I must have been insane. What was I doing? But because of that commitment, I will never turn away from vanquishing the mental afflictions. I will be tenacious and intent on revenge. Listen to the, you know, the words here. Listen to the, you know, the sentiment. This is not namby-pamby. Namby-pamby? This is not like wussy, you know, spirituality. This is like down and dirty, let's get busy, you know, kick their asses. You know, I will be tenacious and intent on revenge. Who is he talking to? Mental afflictions, don't forget. I will wage war against my mental afflictions, except for the kind that are designed to obliterate mental afflictions. But, okay, so this is a wonderful verse about fighting fire with fire. You know, because the first two lines are like, come on, Master Shanti Devi, you lost it, man. You're supposed to be like Shanti. Peaceful, right? I will be tenacious and seek revenge. You know? I'm really going to, like, kick their asses. So that kind of motivation, he says, when directed toward your mental afflictions, is a positive thing. It's not a mental affliction to have a mental affliction about mental afflictions. So get angry. At what? At anger. Be proud. About what? Your ability to be less selfish. Right? Desire. What? Strongly. Desire. What? The end of desire. Contentment. How can you reach something if you don't desire it? It's a little paradoxical, of course, to desire contentment. But you have to desire it if you're going to work towards it. Right? So you're using these mental afflictions against themselves. This is a very, very important teaching in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. That's expanded out later in the esoteric texts of Tibetan Buddhism. Let my guts ooze out and my head fall off. Whatever. Namame is a sort of expression in Sanskrit. Namame. It's a, oh, my name, literally. But, it, you know, whatever. It's an idiom. But I will never, no matter what, bow before my great enemy, the mental afflictions. An enemy, even when exiled, may find asylum in another country. And from there, he's talking about a human enemy, no? And from there return with forces reassembled, but there's no such course of action available to the mental affliction enemies. If I get them out of my head, there's no place for them to go and reassemble. Where would they reside? Where would what resides in my own mind go if banished? From which place would it arrive? Would it strive to defeat me? It's only because I make no effort that I am so stupid. Munda buddhi. Buddhi means intellect. Munda means feeble. I have a feeble intellect. I don't get it, see. It's only because I make no effort that I'm so stupid, because I don't realize that they are, that these mental afflictions don't live in anywhere else but me. The wretched afflictions will be mastered by the perspective of wisdom, by understanding where they are and what they are. So the last kind of verse is like identified. It's kind of important, so we'll just spend a few minutes. We only have a few minutes, but we'll spend it. The mental afflictions are not located in the objects of the senses. Anger is not in the person that irritates you. That's not where your anger, the anger that comes in your mind, is. It's not in that external object. Okay? Got it? That's already like an important beginning, is to understand that other people cannot make you angry. They don't have the anger-making capacity. Because anger isn't in the object. It isn't out there in the sensual object. Nor are they in the group of sense powers. So it's not in the hearing of the words that the irritating person said. You just picked up syllables and decibels. Right? The sense power, the hearing power, the seeing power, the tasting power, etc. They just pick up data. And then what happens? The mind interprets the data. Nor are they anywhere in between. So they're not in the object. They're not in the receptor of the external object, the hearing, the seeing, etc. They're not in the sense powers. And they're nowhere in between. So there are only one place they can be. Anger, jealousy, envy, pride, right? Only one other place they can be is in you. Where are these things that agitate the whole world located? It's only an illusion. Because they're not real either. The mental afflictions are illusory. They are names that we label onto a series of discrete moments of feeling. Each moment being slightly different. Moment by moment, things are happening in our minds, aren't they? And then we just overlay some label on it. I'm angry. They're not really there in a way. They're just labels. They exist in the same way that anything else exists, nominally, just by name alone. So if you rename them, see, this is the kind of interesting implication. If you give them a new name, they aren't the same thing anymore. So instead of saying, for example, I have such problems, if you, even to just say, I have such challenges, and really believe that, not just say that because it sounds good and, all the New Agers will love you. But if you really believe that these are challenges, they're not problems, they're challenges, then you've changed it already. See? Nothing out there, nothing, there's no problem out there, there's no problem, in the senses. The only problem is in the labeling. And of course, we're forced, by karma to label things the way we do. So it takes a kind of an insertion into the karmic flow of things to start the process of relabeling, of thinking about experiences and emotions, and especially thinking about yourself differently. Labeling yourself is the big label. I am, say your name to yourself, as if that was something other than just a name. It's like labeling. It's like labeling a river. Remember when there was an LA River? Is there still an LA River? Is the LA River a thing or a process? It's a process, of course, constantly changing process, right? But we say LA River, we think that we're talking about something. We're not just talking about flow. We're not just talking about process. And it's exactly the same when we label ourselves. When we say your name to yourself, we think that refers to something, when it just refers to a constant flow, constantly changing flow. Having reflected on all this, I will make an effort. I will make an effort to put into practice the teachings that have been taught to me. Why would someone who could be cured by taking the prescribed medicine deviate from his doctor's instructions? So, the prescription has been given. I function in this case as the doctor. The prescription has been given. Now take your medicine. Okay? Fight the mental afflictions. And only you can do that. The exercise for this class is for 5 to 10 minutes each day, review all the things that are going right for you. This is to pick up on the leisure and fortune, you know, aspect of this chapter. And this is a very, very good practice to do. It's not like making, you don't make anything up, okay? Just observe, like, what an awesome life you're leading. How much money you have, how many things you have, how many luxuries you have, how many friends you have, how many great experiences you're having, how many places you've been, you know, it's endless. So just a couple of them for five or ten minutes for a week, every day, for a week, to just get you in the habit of observing. So some of you have been with us for all the classes know that each one of these classes has an exercise that goes on for a week. So if you're going to do this course, this workshop, with any kind of like benefit to yourself, you will spend 4 weeks doing it. 1 week for each class. Okay? And by the way, if there's anyone listening, because this is being recorded, who's interested in teaching this course to someone else, ideally it would be taught over 4 weeks. With one class per week and then putting it into practice for a week. You see, we're doing it crash course here over a weekend. But if it's going to be any benefit from these teachings, you got to like pay attention to that last verse of the fourth chapter. Take your medicine. You got to put it into practice. You know the prescription. You just got to get it filled and ingest it. And that's the work. That's your work. And my work's done now. Not quite. I got one more class, and then my work's done. So we'll meet again at 4:30 for chapter 5.